All his life, he had been taught that. I decided the only way was to convince him the MiG would go straight to America. So I flew to Washington and saw Richard Helms, then director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He listened and said, no problem. He was always very good like that. He arranged for the U.S. military attaché in Baghdad to meet Munir. The attaché confirmed the plane would be handed over to the United States. He gave Munir a lot of talk about helping America catch up with the Russians. Munir bought it and agreed to go ahead. The operation now took on a pace of its own. Joseph's relative received his Iraqi exit permit and flew to Geneva. From there, he sent a postcard. The hospital facilities are excellent. I am assured of a total recovery. The message was the signal that the second $500,000 had been deposited. Reassured, Joseph told Bacon the family were ready. On the night before Munir would make his flight, Joseph led them in a convoy of vehicles north to the cool of the mountains. Iraqi checkpoints did not trouble them. Residents moved every summer away from the stifling heat of Baghdad. In the foothills, Kurds waited with the Israeli liaison team. They led the family deep into the mountains, where Turkish Air Force helicopters were waiting. Flying below radar, they crossed back into Turkey. An Israeli agent made a call to Munir, telling him his sister had safely delivered a baby girl. Another coded signal had been safely transmitted. Next morning, August 15, 1966, at sunup, Munir took off for a practice mission. Clear of the airfield, he kicked in the MiG's afterburners and was over the border with Turkey before other Iraqi pilots could be instructed to shoot him down. Escorted by U.S. Air Force Phantoms, Munir landed at a Turkish air base, refueled, and took off again. Through his earphones, he heard the message in plain talk this time, "All your family are safe and on the way to join you." An hour later, the MiG touched down at a military airbase in northern Israel. Mossad had now become a serious player on the world stage. Exiting the highway north of Tel Aviv, Meir Amit continued to maintain his speed at a little above the speed limit. Discreetly bucking the system had continued to be part of his life since he had masterminded the theft of an Iraqi jet. Blindly refusing to follow the rule book, he put down as stemming from his Galilean background, "We are a stubborn lot." He had been born in King Herod's favorite city, Tiberias, close to the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and spent most of his early life on a kibbutz. Long ago, all traces of the region's flat accent had been smoothed away by his mother, an elocution teacher. She had also instilled her son's sense of independence, his refusal to tolerate fools, and a barely concealed contempt for city dwellers. Most important of all, she had encouraged his analytical skills and ability to think laterally. In his long career, he had used those qualities to discover an enemy's intention. Often action could not wait for certainty, and motive and deception had been at the center of his work. At times, his critics in the Israeli intelligence community had been concerned at what they saw as his imaginative leaps. He had one answer for them all. Read the case file on the stolen MiG. On this March morning in 1997, as he continued to drive out of Tel Aviv, Meir Amit was officially on the retired list. But no one in Israeli intelligence believed that was the case. His vast knowledge was too valuable to be put in cold storage. The previous day, Meir Amit had returned from Ho Chi Minh City, where he had visited former Viet Cong intelligence officers. They had swapped experiences and had found common ground over besting superior opposition, the Vietnamese against the Americans, Israel fighting the Arabs. Meir Amit had made other trips to places where his secret maneuvers had once created havoc. Amman, Cairo, Moscow. No one dared to question the purpose of these visits, just as during his five momentous years as Director General of Mossad, from 1963 to 68, no one had mounted a successful challenge over his sources or methods. In that period, he had turned HUMINT, human intelligence gathering, into an art form, No other intelligence agency had been able to match his agents on the ground in collecting information. He had placed spies in ever greater numbers in every Arab country across Europe, down into South America, throughout Africa, and in the United States. His Katzas had penetrated the Jordanian Mukhabarat, the best of the Arab intelligence services, and Syrian military intelligence, the most cruel. They were men of cool nerve and steel resolve that no novelist would have dared to invent. Soon after he became director general, Meir Amit circulated within the service a memo stolen by an agent from Yasser Arafat's office. Quote, Mossad has a dossier on each of us. They know our names and addresses. We know there are two photographs with each of our files. One is a copy of how we look without a keffiyeh, and the other wearing one. So the Mossad have no difficulty tracking us down with or without our headdresses. Unquote. To create further fear, Meir Amit had recruited an unprecedented number of Arab informers. He worked on the principle that by the law of averages, he would discover a sufficient number who would be useful. Bribed Arabs had betrayed PLO gunmen and revealed their arms caches, safe houses, and travel arrangements. For each terrorist killed by Mossad, Meir Amit paid an informer a bonus of $1. In the run-up to the Six-Day War in 1967, there was either a Mossad Katza or an informer inside every Egyptian airbase and military headquarters. There were no fewer than three in the General High Command headquarters in Cairo, staff officers who had been persuaded by Meir Amit. How he had done so had remained his closely guarded secret. There are some matters best left that way. To each informer and agent in place, he had given the same instruction. As well as the big picture, he wanted the small details. How far did a pilot have to walk from his barracks to the mess for his meals? How long was a staff officer held up in the notorious Cairo traffic jam? Did a key planner have a mistress? Only he fully understood how such disparate matters would be used. One Katza had managed to get himself a job as a waiter in the officer's mess in a frontline fighter base. Every week he provided details of aircraft readiness and the lifestyle of pilots and technicians. Their drinking habits and sexual pleasures were among the information secretly radioed to Tel Aviv. Mossad's newly created Department of Psychological Warfare, Lo Amal Psychologit, LAP, worked around the clock preparing files on Egyptian flyers, ground crew, and staff officers, their flying skills, whether they had achieved their rank through ability or influence, who had a drink problem, frequented a brothel, had a predilection for boys. Well into the night, Meir Amit pored over the files, looking for weaknesses, for men who could be blackmailed into working for him. It was not a pleasant task, but intelligence is often a dirty business. Egyptian families of servicemen began to receive anonymous letters, posted in Cairo, giving explicit details of their beloved's behavior. Informers reported back to Tel Aviv details of family rows, which led to aircrew going on sick leave. Staff officers had anonymous phone calls giving information about a colleague's private life. A teacher at school was called by a sympathetic-sounding woman to be told that the only reason a pupil was doing badly was because her father, a senior officer, had a secret male lover. The call led to the officer shooting himself. This relentless campaign caused considerable dissension within the Egyptian military and brought great satisfaction to Meir Amit. By early 1967, it became clear from all the evidence his Egyptian network was producing that the country's leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser, was preparing for war against Israel. More informers were recruited by fair means or foul, helping Mossad to know as much about the Egyptian Air Force and its military command as did Cairo. By early May 1967, he was able to give Israel's Air Force commanders the precise time of day they should launch a knockout strike against the Egyptian air bases. Mossad's analysts had produced a remarkable blueprint of life on all Egyptian air bases. Between 7:30 a.m. and 7:45 a.m., airfield radar units were at their most vulnerable. In those 15 minutes, the outgoing night staff were tired after the long shift, while their incoming replacements were not yet fully alert and were often late in taking over due to slow service in the mess halls. Pilots breakfasted between 7:15 a.m. and 7:45 a.m. Afterward, they usually walked back to their barracks to collect their flying gear. The average journey took 10 minutes. Most flyers spend a further few minutes in the toilets before going to the flight lines. They arrived there around 8 a.m., the official start to the day. By then, ground crew had begun to roll out aircraft from their hangars to be fueled and armed. For the next 15 minutes, the flight lines were crammed with fuel trucks and ammunition trucks. A similar detailed itinerary was prepared for the movements of staff officers in the Cairo High Command. The average officer took 30 minutes to drive to work from his house in one of the suburbs. Strategic planners were often not at their desks before 8:15 a.m. They usually spent a further 10 minutes settling in, sipping coffee, and gossiping with colleagues. The average staff officer did not properly start studying overnight signals traffic from the fighter bases until close to 8:30 a.m. Meir Amit told the Israeli Air Force commander that the time their aircraft must be over their targets should be between 8 a.m. and 8:30 a.m. In those 30 minutes, they would be able to pulverize enemy bases, knowing that the Cairo High Command would be without many of its key personnel to direct the fight back. On June 5, 1967, Israel's Air Force struck at precisely 8:01 a.m. with deadly effect, sweeping in low over the Sinai to bomb and strafe at will. In moments, the sky turned reddish-black with the flames from burning fuel trucks and exploding ammunition and aircraft. In Tel Aviv, Meir Amit sat looking out of his office window toward the south, knowing his intelligence analysts had virtually settled the outcome of the war. It was one of the most stunning examples of his extraordinary skills, and even more remarkable given the numerical size of Mossad. Much of the Mossad's success came from the rules Meir Amit laid down for selecting katzas, the field agents, who ultimately were at the cutting edge of Mossad's success. He fully understood the deep and complex motives which allowed them, upon selection, to shake his hand, the gesture that acknowledged they were now his to command as he wished. While much else had changed in Mossad, Meir Amit knew that his recruiting criteria had remained intact. No katza is accepted into Mossad who is primarily motivated by money. The overly zealous Zionist also has no place in this work. It gets in the way of a clear understanding of what the job is all about. It is one that calls for calm, clear, far-sighted judgment and a balanced outlook. People want to join Mossad for all kinds of reasons. There is the so-called glamour. Some like the idea of adventure. Some think joining will enhance their status. Small people who want to be big. A few want the secret power they believe being in Mossad would give them. None of these are acceptable reasons for joining. And always, always, you must ensure your man in the field knows he has your total support, that you will look out for his family, make sure his kids are happy. At the same time, you must protect him. If his wife starts to wonder if he has another woman, reassure her he has not. If he has, don't tell her. If she goes off the rails, bring her back on the straight and narrow. Don't tell her husband. You want nothing to distract him. The job of a good spymaster is to treat his people as family. Make them feel he is always there for them, day, night, no matter what the time. This is how you buy loyalty. Make your katza do what you want. And in the end, what you want is important. Each katza underwent 3 years of intensive training, including being subjected to severe physical violence under interrogation. He or she became proficient in the use of Mossad's weapon of choice, the 22 caliber Beretta. The first katzas stationed outside the Arab countries were in the United States, Britain, France, and Germany. In the United States, there were permanent katzas in New York and Washington. The New York katza had special responsibility for penetrating all UN diplomatic missions and the city's many ethnic groups. The Washington katza had a similar job with the additional responsibility of monitoring the White House. Other cutters operated in areas of current tensions, returning home when a mission ended. There were several spies whose bravery would remain in the annals of Mossad. Eli Cohen was born in Alexandria, Egypt, on December 16, 1924. Like his parents, he was a devout Orthodox Jew. In December 1956, he was among the Jews expelled from Egypt after the Suez Crisis. He arrived in Haifa and at first felt himself a stranger in his new land. In 1957, he was recruited into Israeli military counterintelligence, but his work as an analyst bored him. He began to inquire how he could join Mossad, but was rejected. Meir Amit recalled, "We heard that our rejection had deeply offended Eli Cohen. He resigned from the army and married an Iraqi woman named Nadia." For 2 years, Cohen led an uneventful life as a filing clerk in a Tel Aviv insurance office. Unknown to him, his background had surfaced in a trawl through Mossad's reject files by Meir Amit, who was looking for a certain kind of agent for a very special job. Finding no one suitable in the active files, he had gone to the rejects. Cohen seemed the only possibility. He was put under surveillance. The weekly reports by Mossad's recruiting office described his fastidious habits and devotion to his wife and young family. He was hardworking, quick on the uptake, and worked well under pressure. Finally, he was told that Mossad had decided he was suitable after all. Eli began an intensive 6-month course at the Mossad training school. Sabotage experts taught him how to make explosives and time bombs from the simplest of ingredients. He learned unarmed combat and became a first-class marksman and an accomplished burglar. He discovered the mysteries of encoding and decoding, how to work a radio set, use invisible inks, and hide messages. He constantly impressed his instructors with his skills. His phenomenal memory came from memorizing tracts of the Torah as a young man. His graduate report stated he had every quality needed by a katza. Still, Meir Amit hesitated. "I asked myself 100 times, can Eli do what I want? I always showed him, of course. My confidence was always in place. I never wanted him for a moment to think he would always be one step from the trapdoor which would send him to kingdom come. Yet some of the very best brains in Mossad put everything they knew into him. Finally, I decided to run with Eli." Meir Amit spent weeks creating a cover story for his protege. They would sit together, studying street maps and photographs of Buenos Aires, so that Cohen's new background and name, Kamil Amin Tarabes, became totally familiar. The Mossad chief saw how quickly Eli learned the language of an exporter-importer to Syria. He memorized the difference between waybills and freight certificates, contracts and guarantees, everything he would need to know. He was like a chameleon, absorbing everything. Before my very eye, Eli Cohen faded and Tarbez took over. The Syrian, who had never given up a longing to go home to Damascus. Every day Eli became more confident, more certain and keen to prove he could carry off the role. He was like a world champion marathon runner, trained to peak at the start of the race. But he could be running his for years. We had done all we could to show him how to pace his new life, to live the life. The rest was up to him. We all knew that. There was no big goodbye or send-off. He just slipped out of Israel, the way all my spies went. In the Syrian capital, Cohen quickly established himself in the business community and developed a circle of high-level friends. These included Mazi Zahareddin, nephew of Syria's president. Zahareddin was a boastful man, eager to show how invincible Syria was. Cohen played to that. In no time, he was being given a guided tour of Syria's Golan Heights fortifications. He saw the deep concrete bunkers housing the long-range artillery sent by Russia. He was even permitted to take photographs. Within hours of 200 T-45 Russian tanks arriving in Syria, Cohen had informed Tel Aviv. He even obtained a complete blueprint of Syria's strategy to cut off northern Israel. The information was priceless. While Cohen continued to confirm Mayor Amit's belief that one field agent was worth a division of soldiers, he eventually began to become reckless. Cohen had always been a soccer fan. The day after a visiting team beat Israel in Tel Aviv, he broke the strict business-only rule about transmissions. He radioed his operator, "It is about time we learned to be victorious on the soccer field." Other unauthorized messages were translated, "Please send my wife an anniversary greeting," or "Happy birthday to my daughter." Mayor Amit was privately furious, but he understood enough of the pressures on the agent to hope Cohen's behavior was no more than a temporary aberration often found in the best of agents. He said, "I tried to get inside his head. Was he desperate, and this is his way of showing it by dropping his guard? I tried to think like him, knowing I'd rewritten his life. I had to try and weigh 100 factors, but in the end, the only important one was, could Eli still do his job?" Mayor Amit decided that Cohen could. On a January night in 1965, Eli Cohen waited in his Damascus bedroom ready to transmit. As he tuned his receiver to go, Syrian intelligence officers burst into the apartment. Cohen had been caught by one of the most advanced mobile detection units in the world, supplied by the Russians. Under interrogation, he was forced to send the message to Mossad. The Syrians failed to notice the subtle change of speed and rhythm in the radio transmission. In Tel Aviv, Mayor Amit received news Eli had been captured. 2 days later, Syria confirmed his capture. It was like losing one of your family. You ask yourself the questions you always ask when an agent is lost. Could we have saved him? How was he betrayed? By his own carelessness? By someone close to him? Was he burned out and we didn't realize it? Did he have some kind of death wish? That too happens. Or was it just bad luck? You ask, you go on asking. You never get an answer for certain. But asking can be a way to cope. At no stage did the Syrian succeed in breaking Eli Cohen, despite the torture he endured before being sentenced to death. Mayor Amit devoted almost all his time trying to save Eli Cohen. While Nadia Cohen launched a worldwide publicity campaign for her husband's life, she approached the Pope, the Queen of England, prime ministers, and presidents. Amit worked more secretly. He traveled to Europe to see the heads of French and German intelligence. They could do nothing. He made informal approaches to the Soviet Union. He fought on right until on May 18, 1965. Shortly after 2 a.m., a convoy drove out of El Mazar prison in Damascus. In one of the trucks was Eli Cohen. With him was the 80-year-old chief rabbi of Syria, Nissim Andabo. Overcome by what was to happen, the rabbi wept openly. Eli Cohen calmed the old man. The convoy reached El Marga Square in the center of Damascus. There, Eli recited the Vidui, the Hebrew prayer of a man about to face death. "Almighty God, forgive me for all my sins and transgressions." At 3:35 a.m., watched by thousands of Syrians and in the full glare of television lights, Eli stood on the gallows. In Tel Aviv, Nadia Cohen watched her husband die and tried to kill herself. She was taken to a hospital and her life was saved. Next day, in a small, private ceremony in his office, Mayor Amit paid tribute to Eli Cohen. Then he went back to the business of running his second prized agent. Mayor Amit recognized his katzas would need support in the field. He created the Sayanim, volunteer Jewish helpers. Each Sayan was an example of the historical cohesiveness of the world Jewish community. Regardless of allegiance to his or her country, in the final analysis, a Sayan would recognize a greater loyalty, the mystical one to Israel, and a need to help protect it from its enemies. Sayanim fulfilled many functions. A car Sayan, running a rental agency, provided a katza with a vehicle without the usual documentation. A letting agency Sayan offered accommodation. A bank Sayan might unlock funds outside normal hours. A Sayan physician would give medical assistance, treating a bullet wound, for example, without informing the authorities. Sayanim only received expenses for their services. Between them, they collected technical data for all kinds of overt intelligence. A rumor at a cocktail party, an item on the radio, a paragraph in a newspaper, a half-finished story at a dinner party. They provided leads for Katzas. Without its Sayanim, Mossad could not operate. Again, Meir Amit's legacy would remain, though vastly expanded. In 1997, there were over 4,000 Sayanim in Britain, almost four times as many in the United States. While Meir Amit had operated on a tight budget, Mossad, to maintain its worldwide operations, now spends several hundred million dollars a month maintaining its assets, paying the expenses of Sayanim, running safe houses, providing logistics, and covering operational costs. He had left them one other reminder of his time as their chief, a language of their own. Its report writing system was known as Nakka. Daylight was the highest form of alert. Ekidon was a member of Mossad's assassination team. Neviot was a specialist in surveillance. Yahalomim was the unit that handled communications to Katzas. Safanim was the one that targeted the PLO. A Balder was a courier. A Slick was a secure place for documents. Teuds were forgeries. When Transworld Airlines Flight 800 crashed off the southeastern coast of Long Island on July 17, 1996, killing all 230 people aboard, LAP, Israel's Department of Psychological Warfare, began a campaign to suggest the tragedy was masterminded by Iran or Iraq, both Israel's bête noire. Thousands of media stories quickly perpetuated the fiction. Almost a year later, after expending some $500,000 and 10,000 work hours, the FBI's chief investigator, James K. Kallstrom, ruled out a terrorist bomb or any evidence of a forensic crime. Privately, he told colleagues, "If there was a way to nail those bastards in Tel Aviv for time-wasting, I sure would like to see it happen. We had to check every item they slipped into the media." LAP struck again after the bombing of the Atlanta Olympic Games. The fiction was spread that the bomb had all the signs of being manufactured by somebody who had learned his skills from the bomb makers of Lebanon's Bekaa Valley. The story took off, and LAP brought the specter of terrorism home to an understandably fearful American public. The only suspect was a hapless security guard at the Games, a man who manifestly had no connection with international terrorism, and when he was cleared, the story died. Again, Meir Amit understood the importance of reminding the world about terrorism. But the warning needed to be copper-fastened, something I always insisted upon. The admission was followed by a shrug, as if some inner fire blanket had doused his spark of irritation. Long ago he had learned to hide his feelings and to be vague about details. For years his strength had been in concealment. In his mind, the downward spiral of Mossad had begun when Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated at a peace rally in Tel Aviv in November 1995. Shortly before Rabin was gunned down by a Jewish extremist, a further sign of the deepening malaise Meir Amit saw in Israeli society, Mossad's then-Director General, Shabtai Shavit, had warned Rabin's staff that there might be an attempt on his life. According to one staffer, the possibility was ignored as being too vague to constitute a definite threat. Under Meir Amit's command, Mossad still had no mandate to operate within Israel, any more than the CIA could do so within the United States. Yet despite his criticisms, Meir Amit liked to say that Mossad had shared the destiny of Israel. Under his tenure, the impact of what it did had often reverberated around the world. Much of that he put down to loyalty, a quality which now seemed to have become passé. People still did their work, as dangerous and dirty as it always had been, but they wondered if they would be held accountable not only to some superior, but to some political figure in the background. That interference could account for the paranoia that regularly surfaced and challenged the concept that Israel is a true democracy. The birth of a nation, Israel, was followed by its near annihilation as Arab armies tried to reclaim the land. 6,000 Jews died, No one would ever be certain how many Arabs fell. The sight of so many bodies all but completed the maturing of Meir Amit. What deepened the process was the arrival of the survivors of the Nazi death camps, each bearing a hideous blue tattoo branded onto his or her flesh. The sight was a reminder of the depth of human depravity. From others, the words would sound inadequately banal. Meir Amit gave them dignity. His military career was the biography of a soldier destined for the top, a company commander in the 1948 War of Independence, 2 years later a brigade commander under Moshe Dayan, then, within 5 years, Army Chief of Operations, the second-ranking officer of the Israel Defense Forces. An accident, the partial failure of his parachute to open, ended his military career. The Israeli government paid for him to go to Columbia University, where he took a master's degree in business administration. He returned to Israel without a job. Moshe Dayan proposed Meir Amit should become Chief of Military Intelligence. Despite initial opposition, mostly on the reasonable grounds that he had no intelligence experience, he was appointed. "The one advantage I had," he said, "was that I had been a battlefield commander and knew the importance of good intelligence to the fighting soldiers." On March 25, 1963, he took over Mossad from Issa Harel. His achievements had become so many, they needed a shorthand of their own. The man who introduced Mossad's policy of assassinating its enemies, who set up a secret working relationship with the KGB at the very time millions of Jews were being persecuted, who refined the role of women and the use of sexual entrapment in intelligence work, who approved the penetration of King Hussein's palace shortly before the Hashemite ruler became a CIA spy in the Arab world. The techniques he created to achieve all that remain in use, but no outsider will ever learn how he first developed them. His jaw muscles tightening, all he would say was, "There are secrets, and there are my secrets." When the time had come, when he felt Mossad could benefit from a new hand at the helm, he had departed with no fuss, called his staff together, and reminding them that if ever they found being a Jew and working for the Mossad created a problem between their personal ethics and the demands of the state, they should resign at once. Then, after a round of handshakes, he was gone. But no incoming chief of Mossad failed to call upon him for coffee in his office on Jabotinsky Street, in Tel Aviv's pleasant suburb of Ramat Gan. On those occasions, Meir Amit's office door remained firmly closed, and the phone switched off. "My mother always said a trust broken is a friend lost," he explained in English, smiling an old man's wily smile. Outside his immediate family, a small tribe of children, grandchildren, cousins, kith and kin, stretching over generations, few really know Meir Amit. He would have it no other way. Wealthy residents in the exclusive suburb of Afeka, in the north of Tel Aviv, were used to seeing Rafi Eitan, a squat, barrel-chested elderly man, myopic and almost totally deaf in his right ear since fighting in Israel's War of Independence, return home with pieces of discarded lavatory piping, used bicycle chains, and other assorted metal junk. Wearing a pair of chain store trousers and shirt, his face covered with a welder's guard, he fashioned the scrap into surreal sculptures with an acetylene torch. Some neighbors wondered if it was a means of momentary escape from what he had done. They knew he had killed for his country, not in open battle, but in secret encounters that were part of the ceaseless undercover war Israel waged against the state's enemies. No neighbor knew exactly how many Rafi Eitan had killed, sometimes with his stubby, powerful hands. All he had told them was, "Whenever I killed, I needed to see their eyes, the white of their eyes." Rafi Eitan had for almost a quarter of a century been Mossad's hands-on deputy director of operations. Not for him, a life behind a desk. There had been no one like him for cold-blooded ruthlessness, cunning, and more. All those qualities had come together in the one operation which had given him lasting fame, one of the most dramatic kidnapping stories of all time, the kidnapping of Adolf Eichmann, the Nazi bureaucrat who epitomized the full horror of Hitler's final solution. After World War II, tracking down Nazi war criminals was initially done by Holocaust survivors. They called themselves Nokmim, Avengers. They didn't bother with legal trials. They just executed any Nazis they found. Rafi Eitan did not know of a single case where they killed the wrong person. Officially in Israel, there was little interest in pursuing war criminals. It was a matter of priorities. As a nation, Israel was clinging on by its fingertips, still surrounded by hostile Arab states. It was one day at a time. The country was almost broke. There was no spare cash for resolving the evil of the past. In 1957, Mossad received the electrifying news that Eichmann had been seen in Argentina. Rafi Eitan, already a rising star in Mossad as a result of astute forays against the Arabs, was selected to capture Eichmann and bring him to Israel to stand trial. The risks were great. He would be working thousands of miles from home, traveling on forged documentation, relying entirely on his own resources, and working in a hostile environment. Argentina was a haven for Nazis. The Mossad team could end up in prison there or even be killed. For 2 long years, Rafi Eitan patiently waited while the first tentative sighting was confirmed, that the man living in a middle-class suburb of Buenos Aires under the name of Ricardo Clement was Adolf Eichmann. When the go order finally came, Rafi Eitan became ice cold. He had done all his thinking of what could go wrong, the political, diplomatic, and for him, the professional repercussions would be enormous. He had also wondered what would happen when, having captured Eichmann, the Argentinian police intervened. I decided I would strangle Eichmann with my own bare hands. If I was caught, I would argue to the court it had been the biblical eye for an eye. El Al, the national airline, had specially purchased from the Mossad slush fund a Britannia aircraft for the long flight to Argentina. Rafi Eitan remarked, "We just sent someone to England to buy one." He handed over the money and we had our plane. Officially, the flight to Argentina was to carry an Israeli delegation to attend Argentina's 150th Independence Day celebrations. None of the delegates knew why we were going with them or that we had constructed a cell in the back of the aircraft to hold Eichmann. Rafi Eitan and his team arrived in Buenos Aires on May Day 1960. They moved into one of 7 safe houses a Mossad advance man had rented. For 3 days, he and the team conducted a discreet surveillance on how Adolf Eichmann, who had once been chauffeured everywhere in a Mercedes limousine, now traveled by bus and alighted on the corner of Garibaldi Street in a suburb on the outskirts of the city, as punctual as he had once been in signing the consignment orders for the death camps. On the night of May 10, 1960, Rafi Eitan chose for the snatch a driver and 2 others to subdue Eichmann once he was in the car. One of the men had been trained to overpower a target on the street. Rafi Eitan would sit beside the driver, ready to help in any way I could. The operation was set for the following evening. At 8 p.m. on May 11th, the team's car drove into Garibaldi Street. There was no tension. Everyone was long past that. No one spoke. There was nothing to say. Rafi Eitan looked at his watch. 8:03. They drove up and down the empty street. 8:04. Several buses came and went. At 8:05, another bus came. They saw Eichmann alight. To Rafi Eitan, he looked a little tired, perhaps how he looked after another day of sending my people to the death camps. The street was still empty. Behind me, I heard our specialist snatch man open the car door. We drove up just behind Eichmann. He was walking quite quickly, as if he wanted to get home for his dinner. I could hear the specialist breathing steadily, the way he had been taught to do in training. He had got the snatch down to 12 seconds. Out of the door, grab him around the neck, drag him back into the car. Out, grab, back. The car came alongside Eichmann. He half turned, gave a puzzled look at the sight of the specialist coming out of the car. Then the man tripped on a loose shoelace, almost stumbling to the ground. For a moment, Rafi Eitan was too stunned to move. He had come halfway across the world to catch the man who had been instrumental in sending 6 million Jews to their deaths, and they were just about to lose him because a shoelace had not been properly tied. Eichmann was starting to walk quickly away. Rafi Eitan leaped from the car. I grabbed him by the neck with such force I could see his eyes bulge. A little tighter and I would have choked him to death. The specialist was on his feet, holding open the door. I tossed Eichmann onto the back seat. The specialist jumped in, sitting half on top of Eichmann. The whole thing didn't last more than 5 seconds. From the front seat, Rafi Eitan could smell Eichmann's sour breath as he struggled for air. The specialist worked his jaw up and down. Eichmann grew calmer. He even managed to ask what was the meaning of this outrage. No one spoke to him. In silence, they reached their safe house about 3 miles away. Rafi Eitan motioned Eichmann to strip naked. He then checked his physical measurements against those from an SS file he had obtained. He was not surprised to see that Eichmann had somehow removed his SS tattoo, but his other measurements all matched the file: the size of his head, the distance from elbow to wrist, from knee to ankle. He had Eichmann chained to a bed. For 10 hours he was left in complete silence. Rafi Eitan wanted to encourage a feeling of hopelessness. Just before dawn, Eichmann was at his lowest mental state. I asked him his name. He gave a Spanish one. I said, "No, no, no. Your German name." He gave his German alias, the one he had used to flee Germany. I said again, "No, no, no. Your real name, your SS name." He stretched on the bed as if he wanted to stand to attention and said loud and clear, "Adolf Eichmann." I didn't ask him anything else. I didn't need to. For the next 7 days, Eichmann and his captors remained closeted in the house. Still no one spoke to Eichmann. He ate, bathed, and went to the lavatory in complete silence. For Rafi Eitan, keeping silent was more than an operational necessity. We didn't want to show Eichmann how nervous we all were. That would have given him hope, and hope makes a desperate person dangerous. I needed him to be as helpless as my own people were when he had sent them in train loads to the death camps. The decision of how to move him from the safe house to the El Al plane waiting to fly the delegation home was filled with its own black humor. First, Eichmann was dressed in the spare El Al flight suit Rafi Eitan had brought from Israel. Then he was induced to drink a bottle of whiskey, leaving him in a drunken stupor. Rafi Eitan and his team dressed in their own flight suits and liberally sprinkled themselves with whiskey, thrusting a flight hat on Eichmann's head and squashing him into the back seat of the car. Rafi Eitan drove to the military air base where the Britannia was waiting, engines running. At the base gate, Argentinian soldiers flagged down the car. In the back, Eichmann was snoring. Rafi Eitan recalled, "The car reeked like a distillery. That was the moment we all earned our Mossad Oscars. We played the drunken Jews who couldn't handle strong Argentinian liquor." The guards were amused and never gave Eichmann a second look. At 5 minutes past midnight, on May 21, 1960, the Britannia took off with Adolf Eichmann still snoring in his cell in the back of the plane. After a lengthy trial, Eichmann was found guilty of crimes against humanity. On the day of his execution, May 31, 1962, Rafi Eitan was in the execution chamber at Ramle prison. Eichmann looked at me and said, "Your time will come to follow me, Jew." And I replied, "But not today, Adolf. Not today." Next moment, the trap opened. Eichmann gave a little choking sound. There was the smell of his bowel moving, then just the sound of the stretched rope. A very satisfying sound. A special oven had been built to cremate the body. Within hours, the ashes were scattered out at sea over a wide area. Ben-Gurion had ordered there must be no trace left to encourage sympathizers to turn Eichmann into a Nazi cult figure. Israel wanted him expunged from the face of the earth. Afterward, the oven was dismantled and would never be used again. That evening, Rafi Eitan stood on the shore and looked out to sea, feeling totally at peace, knowing I had finished my assignment. That is always a good feeling. As Mossad's deputy operations chief, Rafi Eitan's rolling gait continued to take him across Europe to find and execute Arab terrorists. To do so, he used remote-controlled bombs, Mossad's handgun of choice, the Beretta, and where silence was essential, his own bare hands to either garrote a victim with steel wire or deliver a lethal rabbit punch. Always he killed without compunction. When he returned home, he stood for hours at his open-air furnace, wreathed in sparks, totally consumed with bending sculpture metal to his will. In between killing, his other skill was recruiting more Sayanim. He had a routine that played upon the Jewish love for their homeland. Soon he had over 100 men and women across Europe to do his bidding, lawyers, dentists, school teachers, doctors, tailors, shopkeepers, housewives, secretaries. Years later, in another reshuffle of government, a new prime minister, Menachem Begin, named Rafi Eitan as his personal advisor on terrorism. Eitan's first act was to organize the assassination of the Palestinian responsible for planning the 1972 Munich Olympics massacre of 11 Israeli athletes. Their actual killers were already dead, each one executed by Mossad. The first to die had been standing in the lobby of his Rome apartment building when he was shot 11 times at close range, a bullet for each murdered athlete. When the next terrorist to die answered a telephone call in his Paris apartment, his head was blown off by a small bomb planted in the receiver and triggered by remote control. Another terrorist was asleep in a hotel room in Nicosia when it was wrecked by a similar bomb. To create panic among the remaining members of the Black September group who had killed the athletes, Mossad Arab Sayanim arranged for their obituaries to appear in local Arab newspapers. Their families received flowers and condolence cards shortly before each was killed. Rafi Eitan set about finding and killing their leader, Ali Hassan Salameh, known throughout the Arab world as the Red Prince. Using precise timings Rafi Eitan had provided, a rigged car was set to explode. It did, blowing him to pieces. Eitan later began to badger Prime Minister Begin to give him something else to do. After some hesitation, for Rafi Eitan was an excellent advisor on counterterrorism, Begin appointed Rafi Eitan to one of the most sensitive posts in the intelligence community, one that would stretch him intellectually and satisfy his craving for a hands-on job. He was made director of the Bureau of Scientific Liaison, known by its Hebrew acronym, LACAM. Created in 1960, it had operated as the Defense Ministry's spy unit to obtain scientific data by all means possible. In principle, that had meant stealing or bribing people to provide material. From the beginning, LACAM had been hampered by the hostility of Mossad, who saw the unit as the proverbial new kid on the block. Working out of cramped offices in a Tel Aviv backwater, he told his new staff, awed at now being commanded by such a legendary figure, that what he knew about science, he could place in a test tube and still leave plenty of space. But, he added, he was a fast learner. He immersed himself in the world of science, looking for potential areas to target. He left his home before dawn and often returned close to midnight with bundles of technical papers and read into the small hours. There was little time to relax by sculpting scrap metal. In between the huge amounts of data he absorbed, he re-established contact with his old service. Mossad now had a new director, Nahum Admoni. Like Rafi Eitan, Admoni had a deep-seated suspicion of U.S. intentions in the Middle East. The Mossad chief was also concerned about reports from Mossad's own katzas and well-placed Sayanim in Washington. They had discovered discreet meetings between high-ranking State Department officials and Arab leaders close to Yasser Arafat, who had discussed ways to pressure Israel to be more accommodating over Palestinian demands. Admoni told Rafi Eitan he now felt he could no longer regard the United States as a foul-weather friend. In August 1983, Mossad agents discovered an attack was being planned against the U.S. forces in Beirut, there as UN peacekeepers. The agents had identified a Mercedes truck that would contain half a ton of explosive. Under back-channel arrangements, Mossad should have passed on the information to the CIA. But at a meeting at Mossad headquarters, overlooking King Saul Boulevard, staff were informed they were to make sure our people watched the truck. As far as the Yanks go, we're not here to protect them. They can do their own watching. We start doing too much for the Yanks, and we'll be shitting on our own doorstep. On October 23, 1983, monitored closely by Mossad agents, the truck was driven at full speed into the headquarters of the U.S. 8th Marine Battalion, situated near Beirut Airport. 241 Marines died. The reaction in the upper echelons of Mossad, according to a former officer, Viktor Ostrovsky, was they wanted to stick their nose into this Lebanon thing, let them pay the price. That attitude had further encouraged Rafi Eitan to think seriously about targeting the United States. Its scientific community was the most advanced in the world, its military technology without equal. For LACAM to get its hands on even some of that data would be a tremendous coup. The first hurdle to overcome would be the hardest, finding an informer sufficiently well-placed to provide the material. Using the list of U.S. Sayanim he had helped compile during his time with Mossad, he put out the word that he was interested in hearing of anyone in the United States who had a scientific background and was known to be pro-Israeli. For months, it produced nothing. Then, in April 1984, Aviem Sela, a colonel in the Israeli Air Force who was on a sabbatical to study computer science at New York University, went to a party given by a wealthy Jewish gynecologist on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Sela was a minor celebrity among the city's Jewish community as the pilot who had led an air attack 3 years before, which had destroyed Iraq's nuclear reactor. At the party was a diffident young man with a shy smile who seemed ill at ease among the small set of doctors, lawyers, and bankers. He told Sela his name was Jonathan Pollard and that the only reason he had come was to meet him. Embarrassed by such obvious adulation, Sela made polite small talk and was about to move on when Pollard revealed he was not only a committed Zionist, but worked for U.S. Naval Intelligence. So important was the work that he had the highest possible U.S. intelligence community security clearance. Sela could not believe what he was hearing, especially when Pollard began to give specific details about incidents where the U.S. intelligence community was not cooperating with its Israeli counterpart. Sela began to wonder if Pollard was part of a sting operation by the FBI to try to recruit an Israeli. Yet there was something about the intense Pollard that rang true. That night, Sela called Tel Aviv and spoke to his Air Force intelligence commander. The officer switched the call to the Israeli Air Force Chief of Staff. Sela was ordered to develop his contact with Pollard. They began to meet at the skating rink at Rockefeller Plaza, in a coffee shop at 48th Street, in Central Park. Each time, Pollard handed over secret documents to confirm the truth of what he said. Sela couriered the material to Tel Aviv, enjoying the frisson of being caught up in an important intelligence operation. He was therefore understandably stunned to be told that Mossad knew all about Pollard, who had actually offered to spy for them 2 years previously and had been rejected as unstable. Unwilling to relinquish his role, Sela looked around for a way to keep matters alive. That night, using a secure consulate phone, Yosef Yagur telephoned Rafi Eitan. He was exultant. He had his informer. For the next 3 months, Yagur and Sela assiduously cultivated Pollard and his future wife, Ann Henderson. They took them to expensive restaurants, Broadway shows, first-night films. Pollard continued to hand over important documentation. Rafi Eitan could only marvel at how good the material was. He decided it was time to meet the source. In November 1984, Sela and Yagur invited Pollard and Henderson to accompany them on an all-expense-paid trip to Paris. Yagur told Pollard the vacation was a small reward for all you are doing for Israel. They all flew first class and were met by a chauffeured car and driven to the Bristol Hotel. Waiting for them was Rafi Eitan. By the end of the night, Rafi Eitan had finalized all the practical arrangements for Pollard to continue his treachery. No longer would matters continue in their free and easy way. Sela would fade from the picture, his role over. Yagur would become Pollard's official handler. A proper delivery system was worked out for documents to be handed over. Pollard would deliver them to the apartment of Irid Erb, a mousy-haired secretary at the Washington Embassy. A high-speed Xerox had been installed in her kitchen to copy the material. Pollard's visits would be spaced between those to a number of designated car washes. While Pollard's car was being cleaned, he would hand over documents to Yagur, whose own car would be undergoing a similar process. Concealed beneath the dash was a battery-operated copier. Both Erb's apartment and the car wash facilities were close to Washington's National Airport, making it easier for Yagur to fly back and forth to New York. From the consulate, he transmitted the material by secure fax to Tel Aviv. Rafi Etan returned to Tel Aviv to await results. They exceeded his wildest expectations. Details of Russian arms deliveries to Syria and other Arab states, including the precise location of SS-21 and SA-5 missiles, maps and satellite photographs of Iraqi, Syrian, and Iranian arsenals, including chemical and biological manufacturing plants. Rafi Eitan quickly obtained a clear picture of U.S. intelligence gathering methods, not only in the Middle East, but in South Africa. Pollard had provided reports from CIA operatives which provided a blueprint for the entire U.S. intelligence network within the country. One document contained a detailed account of how South Africa had managed to detonate a nuclear device on September 14, 1979, in the southern end of the Indian Ocean. The Pretoria government had steadfastly denied it had become a nuclear power. Rafi Eitan arranged for Mossad to pass over copies of all material relating to South Africa to Pretoria, virtually destroying the CIA network in South Africa. 12 operatives were forced to hurriedly leave the country. During the next 11 months, Jonathan Pollard continued to asset-strip U.S. intelligence. Over 1,000 highly classified documents, 360 cubic feet of paper, were transmitted to Israel. There, Rafi Eitan devoured them before passing over the material to Mossad. The data enabled Nahum Admoni to brief Shimon Peres's coalition government on how to respond to Washington's Middle East policies in a manner previously impossible. One note-taker at the Sunday cabinet meetings in Jerusalem claimed that listening to Admoni was the next best thing to sitting in the Oval Office. We not only knew what was the very latest thinking in Washington on all matters of concern to us, but we had sufficient time to respond before making a decision. Pollard had become a crucial factor in the mysteries of Israeli policymaking and the intricacies of choosing options. Rafi Eitan authorized an Israeli passport for Pollard in the name of Danny Cohen, as well as a generous monthly stipend. In return, he asked Pollard to provide details about the electronic eavesdropping activities of the National Security Agency in Israel and the bugging methods used against the Israeli embassy in Washington and its other diplomatic stations within the United States. Before Pollard could supply the information, he was arrested on November 21, 1985, outside the Israeli embassy in Washington. Hours later, Yagur, Sela, and the embassy secretary in Washington had all caught an El Al flight from New York to Tel Aviv before the FBI could stop them. In Israel, they disappeared into the protective arms of a grateful intelligence community. Pollard was sentenced to life imprisonment and his wife to 5 years. Meantime, Rafi Eitan was rejoicing in the success of another operation he had also mounted against the United States that had made Israel the first nuclear power in the Middle East. In the darkness of a Tel Aviv cinema, in 1945, Rafi Eitan had watched the birth of the nuclear age over Hiroshima. While all around him young soldiers whistled and cheered at the newsreel footage of the devastated Japanese city, he had only two thoughts. Would Israel ever possess such a weapon? Suppose her Arab neighbors obtained one first? Trouble had begun in 1956, when France had sent a 24-megawatt reactor to Israel. Ben-Gurion announced its purpose was to provide a pumping station to turn the desert into an agricultural paradise by desalinating 1 billion cubic gallons of seawater annually. There was protest. Even Ariel Sharon, then and still Israel's leading hawk, vehemently opposed the nuclear arsenal. "We have the best conventional forces in the region." Ignoring all opposition, Ben-Gurion gave the order for the reactor to be sited in the Negev Desert, close to the bleak, sand-blown settlement at Dimona. Dimona's silver dome, beneath which was the reactor, rose above the desert heat. Dimona employed over 2,500 scientists and technicians. They worked within the most fortified plant on Earth. By itself, the reactor could not provide Israel with a nuclear bomb. To produce one required fissionable material, uranium or plutonium. The handful of nuclear powers had agreed among themselves never to provide as much as a gram of either substance to all those outside their exclusive club. Imposing though it was, the reactor at Dimona was little more than a showpiece until it received fissionable materials. 3 months after the reactor had been installed, a small nuclear material processing company opened for business in a converted World War II steel plant in the unappealing town of Apollo, Pennsylvania. The company was called the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, NUMEC. Its chief executive was Dr. Salman Shapiro. On Lacombe's computer database of prominent American Jews with a scientific background, Shapiro was also listed as a prominent fundraiser for Israel. Rafi Eitan knew he had found a potential answer to how to provide the Dimona reactor with fissionable material. The son of an Orthodox rabbi, Salman Shapiro's brilliance had already carried him far. And since some of his relatives had been Holocaust victims, Shapiro, in his typical discreet way, had provided several million dollars for an institute in Haifa that offered tuition in science and engineering. In 1957, Shapiro had left Westinghouse and set up NUMEC. It had 25 stockholders, all openly sympathetic to Israel. NUMEC had won a number of contracts to recover enriched uranium, a process that usually led to the loss of a quantity of uranium during the salvage operation. There was no way of telling how great or when the loss had taken place. In February 1961, President John F. Kennedy wrote to Ben-Gurion suggesting that Dimona should be regularly inspected by the International Atomic Energy Agency.